Remember when a pale ale or IPA actually meant something? Clear as a bell, crisp bitterness, pine, citrus, a little bit of resin, and that first sip would snap you awake. Somewhere along the line, we lost it. But today, I'm here to help you bring back that classic style. One for me, which is my Epiphany beer. I'm flying solo for this episode, giving Adzi the day off, and today I'm going to go deep into how to brew a West Coast pale ale or IPA that's clean, stable, sells by the pint, and actually wins medals. Stick around, because not only am I going to walk you through the five key principles that's going to help you put together that classic West Coast pale ale or IPA, I've got a free roadmap that'll help you dial in the quality of every single brew you make, not just this style. It's time to make pale ale and IPA bloody exciting again, so let's get brewing. G'day brewers, welcome to the Quality Focus Pro Brewers podcast. My name is Hendo and I am a pro brewer coach from the Rockstar Brewer Academy. I help professional brewers all over the world create amazing beer by implementing the right systems in their brewery so that they can make award-winning beer that just sells really well. It's great to see you today, and today we are going to have a chat about West Coast Pale Ale and IPA. And this is a topic that I'm pretty passionate about because I'm of the opinion that West Coast Pale Ale, cast your mind back to Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, this is the beer style that really began the craft beer revolution back in the late 60s, early 70s and beyond. And if we think about where craft beer is at today, we know that there's been a shift to the modern sort of hazification of beer. I call it haze creep as opposed to like dry hop creep. And so brewers, like what's happened recently is that brewers have started throwing in things like wheat and oats and tropical fruit hops and getting their beers to look like fruit juice. Whereas, I think the main reason for that is that it's been more about the Instagram worthiness, I suppose you'd call it, of the beer. And I think Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery summed that up very well a few years ago when he said hazy beers are mainly about taking photos of it in Instagrams. But that's not what I want to talk about today. While I love a good hazy beer and a good New England IPA occasionally and that sort of thing in the diverse range of beers that I love to drink, today I just want to cast our minds back to the way that things used to be. Clear, crisp, firm bitterness, great beers that are just worth drinking. And so today what we're going to talk about is some of the problems that you're going to experience, and I'm going to give you some key principles about what it takes to put together a great classic West Coast style, and together we'll make an amazing beer. So let's talk about some of the problems that brewers experience today when they're trying to create that modern West Coast pale ale or IPA style. Recipe creep. What I see quite often with a lot of breweries is that the principles around hazy beer is starting to creep into those classic West Coast styles. It's an overload of specialty malts, unnecessary wheat, hazy techniques that really just shouldn't be in what should be a clean and snappy beer. Bitterness. There's a lot of confusion around the bitterness that should be in a classic West Coast style. The bitterness in a classic West Coast IPA or pale ale needs to be firm, but not harsh. And if you mess up things like your water chemistry or use the wrong hop variety for bittering, you can find yourself in a situation where you're going to wind up with this harsh, astringent bitterness, even though your IBU calculations tell you that the IBUs are where you want them to be. And the other thing is getting these beers shelf stable and good flavor stability, okay? All hoppy beer styles, whether they're the West Coast or the more modern hazy styles, hops are very susceptible to oxidation, shelf stability issues, and all that sort of thing. Because when oxygen is ingressed into beer, particularly into these hoppy styles, it's the delicate hop aroma compounds that get attacked first, and they are the first thing to degrade. And if you wind up selling beer in your tap room or in a can that's oxidized and doesn't have that nice hop punch that you're looking for, then your consumers are just not going to come back for a second pint. All right. Now, The thing is that this just isn't just about hazy beers versus clear beers. What I saw was brewers struggling with quality at a foundational level. So things like recipe drift, poor shelf life, random batch-to-batch differences. And so that's why I put together the 5-step brewery quality checklist. It's a free checklist that I created just for professional brewers, and it's going to give you a really solid foundation, whether you're brewing a lager, West Coast IPA, stout, doesn't matter, anything in between. It covers the basics around the essential systems that's going to differentiate you from a hobbyist home brewer to someone who's really got things dialed in on the floor in an actual working commercial brewery. So if you haven't grabbed it yet, head to rockstarbrewer.com/checklist or scan the QR code if you're watching this on YouTube that you can see on the screen to download it and use it along the insights that I'm going to share with you today, because beer quality isn't just about the recipe, it's about having the systems and a plan. So let's talk about the makeup of a good West Coast Pale Ale or IPA. So the first thing you need to consider is your malt base. Malt base for a good West Coast style beer needs to be lean and simple. And so what's worked for me is basically using Pilsner malt or even your domestic Turo or domestic Pilsner malt as your base. Then what I'll do is I'll add in a little bit of Munich or Vienna malt just to add in a little bit of bready sweetness. And then optionally, I may add in some crystal malt. Now, let's talk about crystal malt for a second. Now, I tend to not use crystal malt in modern pale ales anymore. And the reason is that crystal malt tends to oxidize quite quickly because of the Maillard compounds in it. If I'm making a really, really low ABV, like say a 3.5% pale ale, West Coast style pale ale, we call that mid-strength here in Australia because of our tax laws, then I would probably consider using some crystal malt in that beer. But as the ABV increases, I want to, and also the hop load increases in that beer, I'm going to want to make sure that anything that could possibly impact the flavor stability is not in the beer to start with. So little bit of pale crystal malt in a low ABV beer just to enhance the body, cool. But once you start getting in that sort of 4.5+ alcohol range, these days I'm generally not using crystal malt, okay? Because of the damage it'll do to the beer. Another thing you want to consider as well is ditch the wheat, all right? So wheat does two things to a beer. So in the mash tun, the wheat is going to convert mostly into monosaccharide sugars, simple sugars like glucose and sucrose and all those sorts of things, fructose, all that sort of stuff. What it doesn't really convert into is things like maltotriose, dextrins, right? Now, when that happens, what's going to happen is the final gravity of the beer is going to be much lower than you expected, and the beer is going to be thinner and drier than you imagine, right? Now, the reason why most brewers put wheat in their West Coast style beers is for head retention. And while I agree that wheat will add proteins, which can be foam positive, the proteins also bring haze. And this is a beer style that we don't want to be hazy. So in combination of adding haze and dryness to the beer by having the wheat in the grist, I generally don't put it in at all. And so it becomes basically Pilsner malt and some sort of light toasted malt like Munich or Vienna. Pretty simple. Next thing we're going to talk about is bitterness, okay? We're going to break down the hops into the bitterness and the flavor and aroma compounds, that sort of thing. Now with bitterness, pick a clean bittering variety. For me, it's either going to be Warrior or Magnum. Magnum's my preference because it's clean, it's crisp, and it's cheap. Okay, and it's consistent, all right? And a really common mistake that I see is that with brewers, particularly with the modern variants of West Coast styles, that they're trying to get somewhere in the range of, say, 30 to 50 IBUs, calculated IBUs in the beer, and they'll actually front load a lot of bitterness up front, somewhere around 20-odd IBUs of bitterness, because beersmith or brewer's friend or brew father is going to take their late additions and say that it's going to add more bitterness than what they anticipate. Now, while I'm all for firm bitterness in these styles, what's going to happen is this is one of the things that's going to lead to harsh bitterness in your beer, okay? So typically for me, what I do is I'm only going to throw probably 5, maybe 10 IBUs as a bittering charge, and I'm going to make sure that most of the bitterness workload is covered by my late additions. Now let's talk about the hop aroma and flavor, right? Now, these days, I find it really funny that a lot of professional brewers get really enamored by the marketing material that comes out from the hop companies. Now, don't get me wrong, I love the hop companies and I love the innovation that they do. When a new hop variety comes out, there seems to be this sort of leap towards trying a new hop variety just for the sole reason that it's new, all right? Now, that's not how I choose hops that are going to go into, well, any hoppy style of beer, but in particular, these West Coast styles of beer. The best thing that you need to be looking for when you're choosing hop varieties is you can stick with the classics like your Centennial and Chinook, but Yakima Chief a few years ago with their Cryopop blend did this really good analysis around the oil fractions in hops, and they talked to what's called the survivability of hop compounds. So if I talk about hop survivability, the earlier in the brewing process that you add the hops, so for example, early kettle addition, late kettle addition, whirlpool addition, they're early in the brewing process, then you've got active ferment hops, end of ferment dry hops, all that sort of stuff. They're later in the brewing process. So if you think about all the times when you add hops into your beer, the earlier you add the hops into the brewing process, the more survivable those aroma compounds need to be to make it to the end of the brewing process and into the glass. Because there's so many things that happen, such as the heat from boiling, there's the CO2 scrubbing that can happen that can drive off those aromatic compounds so they never actually make it into the finished beer, okay? So if you head to the Cryopop website, and thanks Yakima Chief for putting it together, not sponsored, but just because it was a really interesting bit of information, they list some of their varieties which they consider to be more survivable versus less survivable. So for example, for me, what I love using in the Whirlpool is I love Centennial and I love Idaho 7 because they are really, really good survivable hop varieties that are very, very good for Whirlpool additions. And then I'm going to start to use less survivable hop varieties as part of the dry hop. It might be Classic Cascade, it might be some Mosaic, it might be some Chinook or something like that. You pick, you decide. It's not for me to tell you how to create your beer. It's just basically you just need to go and have a look at that website, and I'll leave a link to that in the description below so that you can go and take a look at the different levels of survivability of these hop compounds. The other thing that you want to do is to avoid dry hop creep. Okay. Now, dry hop creep, very briefly, is a two-part process. First part is that enzymes in the vegetal part of the hop flour, and therefore the hop pellets, contains an amyloglucosidase enzyme, which breaks down non-fermentable sugars into fermentable sugars. And then the second part of dry hop creep is those now fermentable sugars become fermentable and get fermented by the yeast. Now, if that happens whilst your beer is in keg or can or a bottle, then re-fermentation is going to occur and you're going to get over-carbonation, over-alcohol, diacetyl bombs, all that sort of stuff. So what I like to do, what works for me to deal with dry hop creep, is I actually dry hop these West Coast styles when I raise the temperature for diacetyl rest. So when there's basically 2 or 3 Plato, so 6, 8, maybe 10 SG points of gravity shift left to go during fermentation, that's the point where I'll dry hop, and I will dry hop at diacetyl rest temperature. Now, I know that's counterintuitive to a lot of the information, particularly around my good friend Scott Janish, who I've had a couple of beers with over the years, where he says to dry hop at a much lower temperature. But for me, what works is I prefer to dry hop during the diacetyl rest. A diacetyl rest with the yeast strain we're going to talk about in a second is going to last a couple of days. And then once I crash chill the beer, out go the hops. So that's basically how to choose your hop varieties. Now, let's talk about yeast. There's only one yeast strain that we need to speak about when it comes to West Coast Pale Ale, West Coast IPA, and that is Chico, okay? So that's US05, White Labs WLP001, Y Yeast 1056, okay? Chico is your workhorse. And I know here in Australia, one of the interesting thing is when you walk into the big box liquor stores that we have and you look around and you see all the pale ales and IPAs that are there, I can pretty well tell you that maybe 90% of them are fermented with Chico yeast, okay? It's got great heritage. It's great. It plays well with hops. It's an absolute workhorse. And probably the best thing about it is that Chico's very forgivable as well. So if you happen to make some mistakes with your fermentation temperature, it's not going to start to put off flavors in your beer. So for me, I'm usually pitching pretty cold, about 16-17 degrees Celsius. And then I'll set the tank to 20, let it free rise and hold up to there. And then I'll dry hop and then set the tank to 25 degrees Celsius. And for diacetyl rest, it's not going to get to 25 degrees Celsius. That's it. All right, really, really simple fermentation. And once the beer has passed the diacetyl test, if you do a VDK test, once the gravity is stable, then it's time to crash chill the beer. The other things that I use with regards to fermentation and cellar along with Chico yeast is I will use some ALDC enzyme to help clean up the diacetyl quicker. So alpha-acetyl-lactate decarboxylase enzyme. Go and check out the enzymes podcast if you haven't listened to that already, because that's where I talk all about all the different enzymes. This is a clear beer style, so I'm going to use a little bit of Clarix, Brewer's Clarix in there. I'm going to use a bit of Biofine to help clear out the beer as well. And I'll probably use a little bit of the Lallemand Aromazyme, which is the beta glucosidase enzyme. So basically that's an enzyme that cleaves off glycosides into a terpene, which is an aroma compound, and a glucose, which gets fermented. And that's going to help create a bright, crisp, hoppy, shelf-stable beer, okay? Now, water chemistry. I love water chemistry. All right, so my general rule for water chemistry for West Coast styles is the lower the ABV, the lower the sulfate to chloride ratio should be, okay? And as you increase the ABV, then the sulfate to chloride ratio should increase. And the main reason for that is that once you start getting up into IPA, double IPA, triple IPA, up in those 7%+ ABV ranges, ethanol tastes sweet, okay? And you need to counteract that with bitterness. And whilst your a bigger bittering charge will help to balance out that sweetness, the thing that's going to do the real heavy lifting with regards to your bitterness balance against that sweetness of the ethanol is going to be your water chemistry, because water is the most abundant ingredient in beer, okay? Make sure that you dial in a calcium level in your water profile of around 70 parts per million or plus. That's going to ensure good yeast flocculation and good yeast health. Again, we're going for a nice bright beer. And then basically what you want to do is you want to build your water profile with purpose and conviction, okay? This is one of the key fundamental things that we teach at the Rockstar Brewer Academy, is how to create a water profile for conviction and not rely on beersmith or brew father or brewer's friend. Have a target water profile, click a button, and expect the salts and acids and all that sort of stuff to be worked out for you. We use Brewham Water. Martin Brungard is an absolute legend. And once you learn the technique, you can create a water profile manually with control in as little as 6 easy steps. It's super, super easy. Now, if you get all this right, what do you got? You're going to have a nice, bright, clean ferment beer that looks great in the glass. Your punters are going to drink pints and pints of this. If you go and enter this into, say, American style pale ale class, American style strong pale ale, IPA, double IPA style classes, if I'm using the BA style guidelines, stick to the style, and you're going to have some success when you go and enter this beer in competitions. And the other thing is that you've got to think about the taproom experience that your consumers are going to experience. So most of the people out there are macro beer drinkers, and they're used to drinking their Bud Light or their Coors Light or their Great Northern or Carlton Draft or something like that if you're in Australia. And you got to take them on a journey. So you should have a killer pale lager in your lineup at your tap room or in your core range, that sort of thing. And I've created an episode about how to formulate a killer flagship lager with my good mate, Matty Cuthbert. And once you get those drinkers hooked, then you've got to take them gently by the hand and take them on a bit of a journey. And the next logical step is going to be some sort of easy drinking pale ale, okay? Now, you might have a cream ale as your big, your yellow fizzy beer, but then there's got to be something after that. And this is just being about smart in terms of getting your customers into the tap room and keeping them there and keeping them drinking beer and putting money in your cash register and your bank account, that sort of thing. So here's your challenge. Pick an ABV band of the West Coast style that you want to produce. It might be a low ABV, 3-ish, 3.5-ish% beer. If you're Australian, it's going to be a mid-strength, somewhere around a normal session strength, so 4 to 5.5, 6% pale ale. You might have an IPA, which is 6 to 7.5%, or you might be doing a double IPA. Pick that ABV band, which is then going to lead you to picking your right sulfate to chloride ratio. Then the next thing you're going to do is go to the Yakima Chief website and have a look at the survivable compounds and pick your hop combo, okay? Pick your survivable varieties for hot side additions and less survivable varieties for cold side, dry hop additions, that sort of thing. They don't have to be the same. You can use a different hop variety in dry hop than you use hot side. With a plan and a system, you'll make consistently better beer, make better decisions, and your beer will stand up in the tank, in the tap room, and in the can out in the market. You've got the tools now, and I want you to go create that killer pale ale or IPA. And if you want to know what's next, go check out this episode. It's got some great information you need.